Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
For the best part of an hour and a half, the two men sat opposite each other in a small, dimly lit room. They smoked, made small talk, did the crossword, and occasionally, as bouts of boredom took him, Johnny had a little snooze, as Albert kept him fed and watered with a steady supply of tea and toast. Earlier in the afternoon of Monday the 28th of February 1949, 39-year-old John George Haig, a respected director of an engineering firm, who was Johnny to his pals and Sonny to his beloved parents, had once again volunteered his time to assist the police following the disappearance of his good friend, co-tenant, and prospective business partner, Mrs. Henrietta Duran Deacon, who he had reported missing. Interview Room 3 of Chelsea Police Station was barely big enough for two men, let alone four. So being just 8 foot square, with no windows, a small table, and only one door, as Chief Superintendent Thomas Barrett and Divisional Detective Inspector Shelley Symes had stepped away, Detective Inspector Albert Webb and Johnny Haig passed the time waiting their return. Johnny was an unassuming little fellow, 5'8" and 10 stone at a push, with a weedy little body that a stiff breeze could easily blow over. Raised well, he was polite, calm and respectful. As a dapper middle-class gent, he was fastidiously neat, with shiny black shoes, a starched shirt and a smart brown suit, topped off with a red tie and socks as a bold flourish of colour. And although Johnny was just a few weeks away from his 40th birthday, he looked almost boyish, being blessed with a little round face, dimples in his cheeks, a side parting, and a feeble little moustache, who spoke well and never swore, but always at a slightly feminine pitch, as if his voice had never broken. Yes, it's fair to say that Johnny Haig was a pleasant sort of chap, who was unassuming, unthreatening, amiable, and easily forgettable. And although they couldn't prove it, the police suspected otherwise. Being locked in an airless box, a ticking clock, a numb bum, and Webb saying nothing, as years in the force had taught him the unsettling power of silence. At 7:15 p.m, Johnny piped up,
"What are they doing now? Symes and Barrett, I mean."
Webb bluntly uttered,
"Well, John, I don't really know. But I should imagine they're working hard in order to get you hanged."
Unperturbed, Johnny asked,
"Hanged? What on earth for?"
Falling into the trap which Webb had set.
"Oh, you know very well that they only hang people for one reason in this country. Don't you, John?"
Over the last 5 years, unassuming little Johnny Haig had befriended 6 wealthy persons, the Swan family, the Hendersons and Mrs. Duran Deacon. He had assumed their identities, inherited their estates, drained their assets, and all 6 had mysteriously vanished. And almost no one had noticed. And as a cocky, impish grin spread across his boyish face, and his eyes, like cold dark marbles twinkled. Johnny smirked.
You can't prove I murdered anybody. You can't prove a murder without a body.
As with a callous coolness, the little killer quipped.
You know those people that disappeared? They no longer exist. No trace of them will ever be found.
And yet, right there, in interview room 3 at Chelsea Police Station, John George Hague, one of Britain's most infamous serial killers, would brazenly confess to 6 perfect murders. But without a body, the police could do nothing. John George Hague was born on the 27th of April 1909, the only child of John and Emily Hague, a mining engineer and a housewife, who were both 37 years old, married for 11, and faithful right through their old age. Johnny's entrance into the world was unremarkable. Born in the bedroom of a small terraced house at 22 King's Road in Stamford, Lincolnshire, a respectable, upper-working-class street for the skilled and educated in a prosperous mining community. Although born a little undersized, his birth was uneventful. As a baby, he was no bother at all. He slept well, ate well, played quietly, rarely cried, and being blessed with no diseases, disabilities or deformities, his health was never an issue. In fact, as to be expected from a family with no history of drink or drugs, assaults or abuse, instability, insanity or incarceration, as a good boy who never had a tantrum, there were no significant events which troubled his early life. In 1910, the family moved to a larger home at 112 Ledger Lane in Outwood, north of Wakefield. And for the rest of their lives, they suffered no period of unemployment, poverty, depression, or separation. As a boy, John wholeheartedly adopted his parents' beliefs by becoming a member of the Protestant Nonconformist sect, the Plymouth Brethren, a small puritanical group with a strict moral code, a dour formal dress, and an unflinching politeness, who believed that the Bible was the word of God. So unless it is expressly stated, everything was forbidden, including Easter, Christmas, and wearing crucifixes. So devout were the Plymouth Brethren, they shunned anything that distracted them from serving God. Hence the Hague household was always neat, clean, but sparse. And with no radio, newspapers or books, except the Bible, they kept their minds pure, their hearts innocent, and all sins at a distance. And to ensure this, hospitality was forbidden, friends were limited to those of their tiny congregation, and John Sr. built an 8-foot wall around their back garden to shield them from any outside influences. It may seem severe, but Johnny embraced his faith, which stayed with him for most of his life. To any outsiders, although the Hagues bristled with an unpleasant air of superiority, often being cold, aloof, distant, and quite snooty, by living closer to the Bible, they never intended to offend anyone. All John and Emily Hague ever wanted was to serve God and to do the best for their son. Age 7, Johnny went to prep school. Being a little boy, dressed in smart suits, shiny shoes, and bow ties, he was often bullied. But buoyed by his faith, he brushed off these insults without any emotion. Aged 11, Johnny won a prestigious scholarship to Wakefield Grammar, a Church of England school attached to Wakefield Cathedral. And although its teachings conflicted with their strict religious beliefs, having become an altar boy, a chorister, and an organist having learned the piano, his loving parents were so proud that they fully supported him right through his education. And because of that, it served him well. During those awkward teenage years, Johnny remained an even-tempered boy who didn't shout, swear, smoke, or drink. But he had no issues with those who did. He didn't fight, start fires, steal, and had no sexual issues. In fact, although a late bloomer, he later became celibate, fearing the rampant rise of sexual diseases and seeing women more as companions than conquests. And being an only child with very few friends, he had a puppy who he adored. Although lonely, Johnny was a good talker and a keen listener. He was a regular churchgoer and an enthusiastic student at the school science club, who was fascinated by machinery and chemistry. And as a bright but easily bored boy, although he won prizes in geography and divinity, his grades were not good. So for fear of upsetting his proud parents and eager to please them, he forged his schoolmaster's handwriting, creating glowing reports which fooled everyone. Upon graduation, Johnny failed to pass his school certificate. But John and Emily Haig weren't upset or even disappointed. Yes, he had lied, but they had raised a good, decent and moral boy of above average intelligence, who dressed well, spoke politely, and dreamed of a career in engineering. And no matter what path he took in life, they knew that their little boy would always excel at his chosen profession. And yet, for the first 27 years of his life, as a decent human being, Johnny had achieved a lot. But as one of Britain's most infamous serial killers, John George Haig, had done nothing. Twelve years and six deaths later, Johnny Haig, the entrepreneur, who lived in a Kensington hotel, drove a red sports car, wore silk shorts under his sharp suits, and was a tad miffed at not only missing luncheon, but also tiffin, tea, and now his din-dins, sat in interview room 3 of Chelsea Police Station, flanked by Barrett, Symes, and Webb. Three shabbily dressed coppers, whose hand-rolled tobacco, stale sweaty suits, and cheap shop-bought aftershave was an insult to his more refined sense of smell. And as Johnny candidly talked, the police listened.
"I've made some statements to you about the disappearance of Mrs. Duran Deacon. The truth is, we left the hotel together, and she was inveigled by me into going to Crawley. Having taken her into the storeroom at Leopold Road, while she was examining some paper for use as fingernails, I shot her in the back of the head."
Throughout, although he was polite, calm and controlled, his boyish face beamed with a cockiness, as being pleased as punch at his own superiority over the police. He knew he could tell them everything, but without a body, they could prove nothing.
"Sulfuring."
From his teens to his 20s, Johnny worked as a salesman at Shell Max, a sign company rep, and as an insurance clerk, where he learned the final legal points of hire purchase agreements. But finding the long hours, hard graft and tiny wage unrewarding, his work record was only described as satisfactory. And why wouldn't it? As an easily distracted dreamer with wide eyes and high hopes, his commute from his sparse, starchy and silent home to the bustling city of Leeds in the grip of the roaring 20s must have felt like the boy had entered a brave new world. A sensual orgy of dizzying delights, fizzing with fast cars, fine foods, gangster films, and filthy lucre. Everything he had been denied. But as a teetotal celibate, Johnny didn't descend into debauchery, as his only vice was pride. Fueled by middle-class aspirations, he dressed in smart suits, neat like his mother made, but topped off with a flash of red as a tiny act of rebellion. He brought a wireless radio. Shocking, I know. But he didn't besmirch his ears by listening to anything vulgar like jazz, only classical, which his father approved of. Yes, he secretly owned three cars, a Ford 8, a Talbot Dirac, and an Alfa Romeo, which he and his pals raced from Leeds to Scarborough. Okay, he dabbled a tad at the horse track, but only because he loved the thought of making oodles of cash without the hard graft. And yes, okay, although he was never charged, his dismissal from the sign company did coincide with the theft of a petty cash box, which he apologized for, and his father paid back all of the missing monies. So considering how his life had begun, surely these were nothing but little acts of indiscretion, which were forgiven and forgotten. On the 6th of July 1934, a little later than most men, 27-year-old Johnny Haig married 23-year-old Beatrice Hamer, a pretty blonde waitress he had met just a few months prior. But this wasn't love. Johnny didn't feel love. After a quickie service at Bridlington Registry Office, with no wedding bells, no bridesmaids, no cards, no confetti, no readings, no religion, one witness, and no parents, Johnny and Beatrice Haig moved into their own home in Leeds. But this wasn't a marriage. Johnny didn't do marriage. Although a pleasant companion, Beatrice was more of a convenience to free the boy from the austere shackles of his stifling parents. And although, as they always did, his parents forgave him, being burdened by responsibilities, his wife was now little more than an impediment to his dreams of prosperity. Scraping by on a paltry £3 a week was no way for a budding entrepreneur to live. How on earth could Johnny be seen as a real go-getter when he never stayed in swanky hotels, rarely ate prime rib steak, his suits were so last season, his blasted bank balance was always bled dry, and he only owned three sports cars? No, this would not do. Not by a long shot. On the 28th of June 1934, just 1 week before his wedding, having perfected the skill of forging a stranger's handwriting and mastering the finer legal points of hire purchase agreements, in a simple scam where they resold rented cars on forged papers, Johnny and two cohorts defrauded three insurance firms out of £960, almost £60,000 today. In his eyes, it was a victimless crime. I mean, he wasn't snatching old ladies' handbags, breaking into young mums' homes, or scaring the bejesus out of bank tellers with Dickie hearts. He didn't use a gun, he used a pen. And let's not forget, no one was hurt, and nobody died. So really, what harm was done? On the 22nd of November 1934, at Leeds Assizes, John George Haig was found guilty of three counts of fraud, with six similar counts taken into consideration, and he was sentenced to 15 months in prison. After 6 months, Beatrice gave birth to a baby girl, who she named Pauline. But as a penniless single mother, with a convict spouse, who made no provisions for his wife and his alleged child, so unable to cope, Pauline was put up for adoption. Life in prison was fine. The bedding was subpar, the uniform was baggy, and the food was far from filet mignon. But Johnny made do by keeping his cell neat, his mind busy, his nose clean, and devoting his time to prayer, education, and silent reflection. And although an amiable little fellow, whose charm made him an easily likable sort, Johnny wasn't a lowlife like the common criminals he had been banged up with. No, his crimes had style, finesse, and just like him, they were superior in every way. His only remorse was for everything that he had lost. His money, his suits, his cars, and his reputation. On the 8th of December 1935, Johnny was released from prison. Having unburdened himself of a wife and a child, he returned home to his loving parents, who would always support him through each test and trial, always forgave him for every sin and sentence, and always stood by him, even as, shamefully, their convict son was excommunicated from the Plymouth Brethren. And with his faith shattered, his heart stabbed, and his pockets empty, John George Haig had reached rock bottom. Throughout his full and rather frank confession, in the stale, smoky confines of Interview Room 3, as the self-confessed serial killer spoke, Barrett, Symes and Webb listened intently. But never once did little Johnny Haig stutter, flush or tremble. His voice never raised, and sweat never broke, as the only emotion he showed was a cocky little grin as he corrected the copper's mistakes. It seemed odd, didn't it, that a former member of the Plymouth Brethren would smoke Galois from something as ostentatious as an 18-carat gold cigarette box, that a fastidiously neat man would allow odd singe marks to sully the underside wrists of his tailored overcoat, and that such a slight and unassuming man could physically kill 6 people and leave no evidence with which to convict him. And yet Haig ploughed on.
Mrs. Duran Deacon no longer exists. She has disappeared completely, and no trace of her can ever be found.
Deliberately leaving a prolonged pause, so Detective Inspector Webb could ask the obvious.
Well, what happened to her?
Haig grinned.
I destroyed her with acid. You will find the sludge, all that remains of her, and my storeroom in Leopold Road. Every trace has gone. I did the same with the Hendersons and the McSwans.
Which posed the police with a real conundrum. If a body no longer exists, how can you prove a murder if the murdered is only missing?
Sulfuring.
Post-prison, Johnny felt like a lost cause. He was too old to be living at home, too sinful to be welcomed back to the church, too solitary to be part of a criminal gang, and as a late 20s, unemployed ex-con, dossing in his elderly parents' home in a small mining town in the north of England. Now, more than ever, he was further away from his dream. In 1936, eager for a fresh start, Johnny moved to London. Dabbling in a few honest, but ultimately unrewarding jobs, including as a clerk and chauffeur, for a good egg called William Donald McSwan Jr., but hating the long hours, hard graft and tiny wage. Once again, Johnny felt the lure of easy money. On the 24th of November 1937, Haig was convicted of 7 counts of fraud, having forged legal papers and stole £3,200, almost £210,000 today. His confidence was high, his scheme was clever, and his crime was brazen. But his mistake wasn't greed, but speed, as on the letterhead, he had misspelt the town of Guildford. Johnny was sentenced to 4 years in Wandsworth Prison. Wealth was within a fingertip's touch. Yes, being banged up was a minor setback, but once again, his near-perfect plan was scuppered by those unpredictable irritants. People. As whatever he stole, they would always want it back. But how could he make sure that they would never notice the missing monies? Released on license on the 13th of August 1940, the 31-year-old repeat offender returned to London, only to see a ravaged, smoking city. Its blackened, crumbling buildings silhouetted by a red, fiery sea, as if he had entered the bowels of hell. As night after night, his whole world was bombed by the Luftwaffe. Buildings were destroyed, homes were smashed, lives were decimated, and as a ragged and hungry Haig slept in a flea-infested doss house, the strict conditions of his early release was like walking a legal tightrope. Ex-con Johnny had to go straight, as one little slip and he was back in the slammer. Only, like Leeds as a boy, although London was a true den of debauchery, still being a teetotal celibate with dreams of becoming an entrepreneur, even at wartime, London was a city of extremes, with blackouts, bomb craters and Bentleys, furs, famine and finger food, destitution, decadence and death. As part of his parole, Johnny did his bit for the war effort by being conscripted as a fire watcher, alerting the fire brigade to any art treasures at risk of destruction by the Blitz. Again, the hours were long, the work was hard, and as he protected masterpieces worth a mint, he did it all for a paltry wage. And like most citizens, his wartime experience was not without its horrors. In a regular letter to his beloved parents, Johnny wrote,
"On one occasion, whilst on firewatching duty, I was talking to a Red Cross nurse at the warden's post. The sirens shrieked, bombs dropped, and the nurse and I moved off to our places of duty. Suddenly, in a moment of premonition, I knew that a bomb would fall close by. So I dodged into a doorway and awaited the inevitable crash. It came with a horrifying shriek, and as I staggered up, bruised and bewildered, a head rolled against my foot. The nurse, who but a few moments before had been gay and full of life, high ideals and a sense of duty, had in one instant been swept into eternity."
But as shocking as it was, the reality was this. In wartime, sometimes people just disappear. Johnny did his damnedest to go straight and to make his parents proud. On and off for 4 years, he worked as a clerk for his old pal William McSwan, whose kindness always saw him through, and did odd jobs for a solid chap called Alan Stevens, a mechanical engineer and owner of the Union Road Tool and Garage Company in Crawley, working at his workshop, clearing out his storeroom, and living in his family home with his wife Evelyn and his daughter Barbara. Johnny had landed on his feet. Except, putting up, getting by, and making do was never Johnny's style. So on the 11th of June 1941, once again, he was sentenced to 21 months hard labour. But not for a cunningly superior scam, having embezzled an impossible fortune, ripped from the mega-rich, having faultlessly defrauded the insured, using a litany of faultless forgeries. No. Strapped for cash, Johnny had illegally flogged off an old fridge, 5 bunk beds, and 60 yards of cloth. And in prison once again, because of these crimes, he had been branded a petty criminal. On the 17th of September 1943, he was released on license and went back to square one. Or so it seemed.
When I first discovered that there were easier ways of making a living, I did not ask myself whether I was doing right or wrong. That seemed to be irrelevant. I merely said, that is what I wish to do. And as a means lay within my power, that was what I decided. If you're going to go wrong in a big way. Go after women, rich old women who like a bit of flattery. That's your market.
By his release, Johnny had spent 6 of his 34 years in several prisons, including Wandsworth, Dartmoor, Chelmsford and Lincoln.
Lincoln. Ah, Lincoln. The worst prison I have ever known is Lincoln. I resented it most bitterly, and made up my mind, after that, that there would be no more inside for me.
But unlike the petty pilferers and common criminals who frittered the endless hours, days and weeks by pinching snout, blagging sweets, and smuggling smokes in a stash of old socks, Johnny dreamed big. As his cellmate in Chelmsford later said,
"He said he'd aim for £500,000 before he'd quit. But everyone just took that as a joke."
Another bunk buddy said,
"He kept gabbling on about this corpus delicti. So that's what we named him."
Corpus delicti, an 18th century English law, also known as the bloodless murder law, states that without a body, there can be no crime. But around these two little words, his master plan was born. The problem was, it's almost impossible to make a body completely disappear. Prisoner Haig was an unassuming little fellow, petite, polite, and polished, who devoted his time inside to being an altar boy and organist in the chapel. He starched his shirts, he made his bed, and always with a please and a thank you, Johnny was charm personified. So being a bright but easily bored boy who once excelled in the school science club, he was given a much lauded job in the prison workshop. When he wasn't spending long hours cutting fresh tin into prison cutlery, zinc plating handles onto kitchen pans, and cleaning rusted iron with sulfuric acid, which stripped his soft skin to a red raw mess and stunk his nose with noxious choking odours. That aside, the prison workshop was the perfect place to fill the endless hours as his restless hands and curious mind fixed, fiddled and tinkered. Here, his entrepreneurial spirit truly flourished. And yet, never once did he make, mould or even invent a single thing that would make his fortune. No, but it was here that he devised the final piece of his grand plan. In 1944, John George Haig was back on the streets, a small, thin ex-con with a weedy frame, a boyish face, a feminine voice, a charming smile, and a truly ludicrous dream to become rich. Only he had no money, no home, no skills, and he knew almost no one. For the first 27 years of his life, unassuming little Johnny Haig was little more than a lost boy eager to please his parents. Over the next 8 years, he was nothing but a failed petty fraudster who at every turn had lost everything. He didn't drink, smoke or swear. He wasn't violent or sadistic. But between 1944 and 1945, he would befriend six wealthy persons, the Swan family, the Hendersons, and Mrs. Durand Deacon. And with near-perfect precision, he would assume their identities, inherit their estates, drain their assets, and all six victims would mysteriously vanish, leaving no trace with which to convict him. John George Haig would become one of Britain's most infamous serial killers. And it all began with a dead mouse.
Sulfuring.
Friends, thank you so much for listening to Murder Mile. That was part one of Sulfuric, the true story of John George Haig, with the second part of six continuing next week. A big thank you to my new Patreon supporters, who are Jane Heath and Miss Marston, aka Sandra. With, as always, a big thank you to everyone who has taken the time to like, share, comment, and review this small independent podcast. It's very much appreciated. Murder Mile was researched, written, and performed by myself, with the main musical themes written and performed by Eric Stein and John Books of Cult With No Name. Thank you for listening, and sleep well.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
That was not too bad. Oh, dear Lord. Oh, God. Oh, that was a beast. Right. Ladies and gentlemen.
The moment you've all been waiting for is finally here.
Extra Mile is back. Extra Mile is back, everyone. Hey, you can all cheer. You can all get excited. Extra Mile's back. We're back. Actually, Motor Mile's back. Extra Mile's back. I mean, I know everyone cares more about Extra Mile. Why? 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 The bit you just listened to is the hard bit. This is the easy bit. This is a piece of piss. The first bit was the hard bit. This is the easy bit. We're back. Extra Mile's here. How are you all? Are you all well? It's been a while, isn't it? It's been a, as they say, a New York minute. I don't know whether that means long or short. I don't know. Don't message me. I don't care. I just something I said off the top of my head. I don't need to know about it. I'll Google it afterwards. We're back. It's been 6 weeks, hasn't it? It's been 6 weeks. So before we start, you're probably all gripped and got your cup of tea in your hand ready. I'm making a cup of tea. Yay! It's everyone's favourite part of the show. Well, I make a cup of tea and I'm opening a window as well because it's bloody. It's very cold outside. It's about 2 degrees today, so it's just above freezing. It's almost cold enough for me to put the fire on, so I think I might do that this weekend. I haven't done that yet because I'm too tight-fisted, but inside is full of condensation. So I'm making a cup of tea. That's on the go at the moment, so you'll hear it boiling a bit. No biscuits. 8 weeks into the diet, it's going well. Since the wedding incident where I couldn't put my suit on, that was a bit embarrassing. So yeah, I've been really good. No chocolate at all. No chocolate. No biscuits. Pretty much nothing that's got fat in it or extra sugar or any of that. Just lots of fruit and vegetables and almost no cake. I've had two Belgian buns, but only because one, the place I'm in at the moment has a Percy Ingles around the corner that I sometimes nip into, and they do a nice Belgian bun. But also, I previously, when I was doing the mini miles, actually, no, when I was researching this, I was in the place, the nice Russian Orthodox Jewish neighbourhood, which has the really, really nice bakery, which has the really nice Belgian buns, which has the kind of the lining of decent, like good icing, good cake, good glacé, but also a really nice lining of cinnamon on the inside. It's really nice. So I had one of those. That was very nice. It wasn't as exciting as I was hoping for, because I hadn't had cake for a long time. But when I had it, I was like, yeah, it was nice. But I was like, it wasn't. It's weird. If I have anything that's a little bit too fatty now, my stomach, because I've got a hernia anyway, my stomach really lets me know about it. So, but the diet's going well. Belly's practically gone. It's amazing if you cut wheat out your diet. Wheat's out of my diet. Dairy's mostly out of my diet as well. So my belly's practically disappeared. I can feel the fat coming off my face. So it's less moon face now.
But also, yeah, the weight always goes off bad places. Right? Like, it's going off my arse. My arse is disappearing. The love handles have gone. They've gone, which is great, but my arse is disappearing. So I'm having to make extra holes on my belt. So you know the diet's going well then when the belt's slipping off. But it's good. I don't feel hungry. I eat all my vitamins and minerals, and I look forward to my meals every day. Nice mackerels and kippers. I've been eating bassa, which is a kind of a Vietnamese fish. It's nice. It's a cross between cod and kippers, but it's kind of a nice go-between. It's very nice. So that's been really good. It's start of November here. I think this is the 7th of November today, I think. Boat has been readied for winter already. Had my new covers done. It was over summer. Got all my coal for winter. I spent the summer, even on the hottest days when it was 38 degrees, I went to Poundland and bought all my cheapy logs. So I've got hundreds of cheapy logs. I've got all my kindling, got all my firelighters, got all my newspapers. Stocked up with fuel. So I did my fuel this week. Got all my gas. Because obviously, you live on a boat, these things you have to find, which is good. Only downside is my generator blew the other day, which was really annoying. So I'm getting that fixed today, hopefully. But whoa, me splashing out, I bought a new generator as well. So that turns up next week, which will be good. So there could be no break. Because yesterday was a bit embarrassing. I was having problems with the engine. So I had to, because I need to charge up my laptop, I had to put my power cable through my window into my neighbour's boat so he could plug it into his power so I could power my laptop. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been able to finish writing the episode. So that's the curse of being on a boat sometimes. You can't always get power. So, yeah, that was good. Just making my tea, a nice PG cup of tea. You can't have a proper PG, two sugars. I'm having my sugars, even though it's refined sugar and you're not really meant to have that. I'm having it in my tea. I don't care about that. And I might treat myself in a bit and have a packet of Quavers. Ooh, excitement. I like Quavers. They're slightly addictable. If you haven't tried them, they're basically not crisps. They're really just the leftover starch from other crisps. But it's like some of the best things in life, like Joe Quavers. Walkers who make them, they make all their crisps, and then that's the starch that's left over, and then basically they just boil up the starch and put air into it, and then we eat that. They put a cheese flavour with it, and everyone goes, ooh, yummy, it's delicious. And they are very nice, but it's just starch. It's like ginger nuts biscuits are the leftover biscuits from all other biscuits, which are put into a big vat, and the reason why it's ginger is because ginger disguises all the flavour of all the other biscuits, and it's brown. They add a brown colouring that disguises all the horrible colours as well. But it's a nice biscuit. I miss biscuits. Getting ready for Christmas. Christmas coming up, so I'll be able to pig out soon. I'm looking forward to that. I'm going to be on the boat for Christmas Day. It's my. I normally go away for Christmas, but this year I've decided to have Christmas on the boat. I've never decorated the boat. I can decorate the boat. I'm going to have some nice treats, some movies. I'm probably going to do something that I want to do, which is I want to go in the middle of Oxford Circus on Christmas Day and just stand there, because no one will be there. It'll be like I've got the whole city to myself. I'm looking forward to that. Silly things like that, and then I'll probably go have a nice meal somewhere. I think if some friends are local, I'll meet up with them for some one or two cheeky beers. But that'll be it. That'll be good fun. So this is the multi-parter. This is a six-parter. I mentioned this at the start. I've already pre-planned this. Unlike the other ones like Blackout Ripper or Reg Christie, I kind of, they expanded as they went along, but these I think I've kind of really focused over the year of what needs to be in this episode, and I know it's a six-parter, so that's good. Hopefully your final part will be on Boxing Day, so I'm powering ahead at the moment to make sure that I'm finished. I need to get this finished by the 21st so I can get some time off, otherwise I don't want to be working Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. And then there will be the omnibus editions, which are the bits without the extra mile and all the crap that's in it. And it's just so if you just want to listen right through, there'll be the omnibus editions. And then at the end of this, to end this season, I'm doing another Q&A. So ask me any questions. What you can do, on any of the social media forums, you can post me a question. That's not a problem at all. And I'll try and add it in. I can't guarantee to do everyone's questions, but I'll try my best. So you can either message me on social media, you could email me, or if you want to, here's an idea, because everyone's got phones anyway. You've all got kind of voice recorders on them or whatever. Record me a short message. Keep it really short, like 30 seconds less. Otherwise, I'm going to have to edit it down. And then you can either email it to me. That might be a problem because it could be a big file. Or if it's a large file, put it in a Dropbox, send me a link. Or there's a nice free app. You can use it. It's an app. It's online. It's called WeTransfer. WeTransfer is really easy. You don't have to sign up to anything. You just download it. It lets you upload stuff and send it to people via a link. It's really useful. And then, you know, a week later, it deletes it, so it's not using up a lot of data. So so that's very good. So you can do that. So Dropbox me or WeTransfer or email me or, you know, whatever. But yeah, if you have any questions, please do let me know. So I'm planning the year ahead. That's done. I've worked out all of the... There's about 50 cases that I want to cover-ish next year. Obviously, some of them will fall by the wayside. So I'll be having a little bit of time off in January, and then I'm looking forward to getting back into the archives. So I'm going to try and make sure that I give myself at least 2 weeks off, because I never properly take time off. So I'm going to... that's going to be January time off, and then middle of January into the archives, be about 4, 5, maybe 6 weeks in the archives. Then we'll be back with a new season of Murder Mile. All very exciting. Don't go anywhere. Don't leave me. Just to say thanks to everyone who's I've met on my tours. That's been really nice to meet listeners coming along. Really nice to meet you in person. Hope you enjoyed the tour. Just to point out, when people do come on the tours, don't expect the same as the podcast. The tour was created first, so it's a very different beast. The tour is not me showing you sites that you would see on the podcast, although if you tell me that you are a listener, I will point them out to you. But there will hopefully be a tour soon that I'm hoping to create, which will be a kind of just a for people who listen to the podcast, it'll be like a walk around Soho, Fitzrovia, other places, and I can point out locations and we can have a little bit, and it'll be a kind of freewheeling kind of chat about it. But if you come on Murder Mile, it is very different from the podcast, so don't expect the same. It's a different beast. It's got its own kind of rhythm and things like that. And it was created 4 years ago. So unlike the podcast, which has evolved, that's very much as it was kind of 4 years ago, but, you know, shorter, better. What else do I need to say? I'm going to turn away, but I'm going to have a slurp of tea. Quiet slurp, because I know people hate slurping and mouthy noises. I totally agree with you. This file was in the archives, the John George Haig file. That was very good. I enjoyed finding that. It was just nice to touch the pages and kind of go through it. There's loads of crime scene photos on there, which were great, and loads of documents, which I'd never seen before. There's loads in the Metropolitan Archive as well. You've got the Crime Museum Archive as well. There's loads of different places where I've been able to get sources for this, so it's been really useful. I'll be posting a lot of crime scene photos on the Patreon account, so you can subscribe to that. It's just like $3 a month. Nothing. That's not even the cost of a Belgian bun. I'll be posting a few online. Not many, but a few. Obviously, the patrons kind of, you know, their subscription actually funds the bulk of the money to keep Murder Mile alive at the moment. So that's really invaluable at the moment. Even though I can't transfer it across at the moment, it's really weird. I'm paying tax on it, but I can't transfer it from Patreon to here because it's in US dollars. Sorry, Americans, close your ears. And the US dollar is really shitty at the moment. The pound should be shitty, but I mean, it is shitty, but in the exchange rate, it's like I lose money transferring it. So literally that money is, I can't take it out of there. It's sitting there. Oh, it's so infuriating. I'm waiting for the point when it all changes, and then, you know, I can make more money off this. At the moment, I'm losing money with it being in dollars. But that's Patreon. That's Patreon for anyway. But that's helping keeping Murder Mile alive. That's nice. That's very useful. So all of that will be on there. Obviously, I've got my YouTube channel, so you can go on there. There will be the usual videos on there. And I've gone back to my old way of putting the full transcripts of the episode on the blogs now. I took them off before for reasons, but it just feels better having them back on there. So, you know, I'll deal with that. This episode is going out about 6 weeks before Christmas-ish. I've just got a load of new Murdermile mugs in, which is very exciting. So if you want to order a Murdermile mug for yourself or for a friend or whatever, that's all good. I can get those out to you. In the UK, they take a couple, 2 days to deliver. If there's America or anyone else, it normally takes five to seven working days. And I'm working on some new designs as well with my good friend Mr. Rushdie. He's done two already. There's two more coming. I'm gonna work on them in January when I've got some time off, along with lots of other things. God, it's gonna be so busy in January. I know I'm saying I'm taking time off. It's probably not going to happen, is it? But not writing a podcast will be very beneficial. So what else is happening soon? I've just got my invite to the Acast Christmas party. That's going to be exciting. Mid to end of November. So we will see if they have any vodka jelly shot cocaine nudie sumo roller coasters. I bet there will be. So, this episode, how long have we done? I'm just checking. Right, okay. I'm just trying to make sure I don't do too much on Extra Mile. I'm not going to give away too much in here, because obviously we've got another 5 episodes to go, so I don't want to add any spoilers in, but obviously you would have noticed that I've deliberately tried to make this episode very different from the Blackout Ripper, different from the Reg Christie, but also different from the regular Murder Mile episodes as well. So there are things in there that I haven't edited it yet, you know. You've listened to the edited version. I haven't, because I haven't done it yet. But I've tried to make it very different, because obviously Sulfuric is meant to be a very different kind of its own beast in its own different way. So there's no kind of location introduction that I'd normally do, where I'm kind of make a couple of jokes about a location, but really I'm describing the location and things like that. But what I decided to do with this one, even though they all have their own individual location that's mentioned, they're just really a reference now. So Chelsea Police Station, if you go on to either my YouTube account or any of the social media, you'll see the video there. Chelsea Police Station is there. It's at number 2 Lucan Place, SW3 in Chelsea. It's a 5-story building. It looks kind of fortress-like. It's on a corner. There's a big kind of door. Above it would have been the usual police lamp, one of the blue ones. It's brown brick on the first to the third floors. The ground is stone, and then there's a slate roof. It basically covers the equivalent of a square block. It's pretty big. But it was, unfortunately, like a lot of police stations, because of successive governments who have not been very good, and we won't mention about a certain Home Secretary who later became Prime Minister, who got rid of a lot of the police because she was making cutbacks, and then she decided to complain that there was too much crime on the streets. I wonder why. So as one of the many police stations that have been shut down, along with police being laid off in London, which is why you rarely see policemen anymore, this was one of the locations that was sold off, was Chelsea Police Station. And as you would expect, guess what it's been turned into? Flats. Yes, of course it is. It's been turned into posh flats. But there's a dispute going on at the moment with the neighbours, because it's surrounded by flats at the moment. And so currently it's being used by guardians who kind of live there cheaply. I used to do this years ago, live there cheaply until it's turned into what it's meant to be. They've been quite lucky. It's been in dispute for about 4 years now, so they've lived there without any real problems, which is great. So that's that. You can see that location on the line. I'll put some pictures on there as well. We will be doing all of the murder locations, and I've got some great murder location crime scene photos that I'll be using as well, but we won't go into those locations first. We've got a couple that we need to clear first to get all of the characters in. And before you ask, if anyone's wondering why I'm not calling this story, spoilers, why I'm not calling this story or John George Haig, I'm not referring to him as the acid bath murderer, which many people do. Spoilers, that's because it's incorrect. I'm not going to go into details, you'll learn more about that now, but I've always had a problem with the fact that people call him the acid bath murderer. It's not a bath. It's like a drum. But obviously people hate the word drum, so it's just little details like that really piss me off. So every time someone uses the word acid bath murderer, it's lazy. Have a go at them. Say, look, it's wrong. It's incorrect. Also, he's a serial killer. He's not a murderer. Do you know? Well, he is. Do you know, it's the same thing, but really it should be a lot clearer. So that's why I spent a long time trying to work out what to call this episode, and that's why I decided to just call it Sulfuric, which I think is a nice name. And hopefully the little new interstitials that I've written in here, as I was writing it, I was like, ooh, it'd be nice if here I just had something that just, instead of going, you know, the three tone, the cult with no name three tone that I use from Man in a Bag, I thought I'd have something different here that would just go, Sulfuric. Just kind of, and then hopefully you hear a bit of a fizzing sound. But I don't know, because I haven't edited it yet. That'll be today and tomorrow and probably Sunday. Oh, this is going to be a bitch to edit. Especially as the narration cut out halfway through. I was recording this and I went to check it and I went, oh, shit. And all of a sudden, part of my narration had disappeared. Let's check it since it hasn't done it again. No, it's still going. Good, but half of it had disappeared. And I don't know why. So it was really, really, really annoying. Right. Not going to give away too much about what happens in the story, but let's dive in quickly to some details about John George Hague. Some of them is already in the script that I've put in there, but obviously I'm going to start editing now, so some of this might disappear. So let's just plough through and see what there is. There might be things that are interesting. Okay, his full name was John George Hague. Obviously his father was John as well. His parents called him Sonny. But he preferred to call himself Johnny. He also calls himself Jack, as many people do who are called John. He was 5'8/9". There's a bit of a disparity between his height. He was 150 pounds. Oh, we know that. Well, that was his weight when he died. I can't remember. So that's about just over 10 stone. He was slim, small framed, described as small, dapper and attentive, with cold, marble-like brown eyes. He was small, not imposing, not strong or physical. He was always polite, fastidiously neat, always wear shiny shoes, had creases in his trousers, smart ties, matching socks. He had his hair cut done every week. He was always clean-shaven, always charming. Didn't really have much of an accent. I've added a little bit of a kind of slash northern twang slash London twang in here. I've let it move a little bit. We've got no actual recording of his voice. So what I've done is I've based this on what people have said. They said his voice was slightly higher pitched than normal, a little bit feminine, had tendency to... He spoke well, but you could tell that you could tell his origins were there. And it was slightly nasal as well. So what I've tried to do is I've tried to recreate a version on there, as I did with the Reg Christie. I tried to base it on what people had said. As mentioned, born 27th of April 1909 in Stamford, unremarkable birth, born at home. His parents had been married quite a few years. He was an only child. Good parents, mining engineer. They had aspirations to be middle class, which was kind of ironic given the fact that they were Plymouth. Oh, this is, I've struggled with it throughout this whole record. Plymouth Brethren. It's a really hard thing to say. Struggled throughout. So even though they kind of renounced things that were modern and kind of technology and kind of anything that would dissuade them away from serving God, deep down they had a kind of a middle class desire to be respectable and middle class, which kind of goes against what they were really doing, the kind of the austerity of it. But you know, that kind of bled into him as well. As mentioned, though, he went to a Church of England school, which was attached to Wakefield Cathedral. He was intelligent but bored. He was good at geography and divinity. He worked in the science club. He was really keen on chemistry and engineering. He loved mechanics. He did a talk about the history of submarines. These were his things. He really loved, just like his father, even though they didn't have radios, his father loved classical music. He loved classical music as well. So he loved Wagner and Mozart and Tchaikovsky. hated jazz, really hated jazz, said it was vulgar, but would later go on to love things like, obviously, opera, ballet, classical concerts. He was really, really kind of focused on being middle class. That's his whole things. But unlike most serial killers, this is really what episode one is about. You probably listen to it and you go, oh, where's the murder? That's deliberately what I've done, is that I've deliberately, with this episode, instead of doing it like I did with the others, like where you see the victim, then at the end we learn why, where they started from. And I thought with John George Haig, because his life at the start is so unremarkable, I thought it was better just to, we'll do it this way. So what I've done, if you listen very carefully, hopefully you've picked it up, but, you know, if not, this whole episode is about, basically I've sat down and gone through everything that you would assume would be there with a serial killer in their earlier life. So, you know, there's no abuse, there's no alcohol, there's no drugs. His parents stayed together. They were really supportive. He was religious, but not fundamentalist. He's kind of, he wavered through religion quite a lot. He wasn't cruel to animals. He loved animals. He had no sexual perversions or predilections. In fact, he was celibate for quite a long while. He was in a brief affair for a bit, in his early 20s, but after that he was like, that was actually one of his first court cases. It was thrown out, but he was named in the court case, and he basically became celibate after that. No history of violence, no history of insanity or depression in the family. He had no health problems at all. He wasn't deformed in any way. He had no diseases. He had no disabilities. Do you know, there's literally nothing there that would, he was bullied a bit. Some of his flatmates, just because he had kind of smaller eyes, they referred to him as chink, as in kind of reference to Chinese people. Oh, the early 1900s, weren't they funny? But, you know, he batted this off. He was quite unemotional. People said he never shouted, never got upset, never really got happy. Just quite an unemotional person. So that's really all you see there as you kind of going through his life. Some things were in there that I kind of decided not to put in the end, because you really can't. The problem with a lot of these details about his early life is that he said them, or even worse, this is what I've tried to avoid as well, is quite a few of his friends would say, he was always a nasty boy. It's like he was always like tripping people over, and, you know, he'd go into a shop and steal things. And it's like, that's hard to pin down, because all of these people said this after he'd been arrested, after the trial. So how much of that is true? It's like with Ian Brady, the Moors murderer. If you read the shitty tabloids always manage to find someone who says, oh, Ian Brady, yeah, he used to get cats and he used to throw them off blocks of flats, and, do you know, he used to stamp on them. He didn't. He loved animals. Like, his book, The Gates of Janus, the proceeds of that went to, out of the four charities he donated the money to, three of them were animal charities. He loved animals. But that's the problem, is years after people have kind of, years after like a serial killer or a murderer has been arrested and all that, all of a sudden people go, oh, yeah, I knew, because they're desperate to say, I knew that, I knew all about this. Oh, yeah, I'm the smart one. But it's not. So all of these are hard to pin down. People said that his parents were cruel, but the more you look into it, the more his parents, their problem was not that they were cruel, not that they were strict, was that they were forgiving. They were constantly forgiving him for his sins. So, you know, to him, there wasn't really a sin. Like when he was caught, allegedly, because he was never charged with it, a lot of this was because his parents were kind of respectable, that a lot of people kind of forgive them for his crimes, his early crimes, not the later crimes, the petty crimes. So, you know, because he was never charged with these, he was just like, oh, you know, he's pretty much always going to get off with it, really. Kind of with the Blackout Ripper as well. When you looked at the Blackout Ripper's early life, a lot of this was because his father had committed some minor fraud offences working as, I think he was a head teacher or something like that, and he, you know, stole some money or something like that. And because he was middle class and respectable, he paid off all the money and he apologised for it, and he was basically forgiven. And the Blackout Ripper saw that as, oh, well, you know, if you're smart and you're polite about it and you're posh and you apologise, you can just pretty much get away with anything. So he didn't see, you know, if if John George Haig would have got severely reprimanded for, you know, theft early on or something like that, his life could have turned out different, but it didn't. He was like, you know, there was no reason to be fearful of arrest. And, you know, even like in here, as you see, when he was arrested, when he was in prison, it wasn't really a problem to him. Again, this is hard to pin down because this is him talking afterwards. There was quite a few letters he sent to relatives and things like that, but, you know, it's the ones afterwards where he goes, oh, you know, prison wasn't really a problem. But obviously this is him talking after the fact, which is always hard. A lot of people use after the fact as fact, but you can't use after the fact as fact because it's clouded by rose-tinted spectacles. So that's always the problem with writing about someone's life. What else we got? Yeah, no, so there was obviously there was a piece here that John George Haig said about his dad, that his dad had a mark on his forehead which was in the shape of kind of a blue crucifix, and he said he was given it by God as a sin because he had sinned. So John George Haig, when he was a child, spent a lot of time looking in the mirror and kind of, you know, every day checking to see if he would end up with a blue crucifix on his forehead for any sins, and they never turned up. It never happened. And he later found out in life that the blue crucifix mark on his father's head wasn't caused by a sin. It was caused by a flying piece of coal. So there you go. What else we got? He was devout at the church. Every Sunday he'd leave at 5:30 a.m. He would officiate at the altar. It would start at 6 a.m. He would do services right through. He would do the 10:30 communion, you know, which is... you know, he was very devout, religious. Religion, he kind of wavered a lot, but religion pretty much stayed with him throughout, which is kind of ironic given some of the Ten Commandments. What else have we got in this list? Whilst at school, he developed an ability to forge. As we mentioned, he later said it was a gift. Hence, he started writing his schoolmaster's reports, which would go to his parents in his handwriting. He says he wasn't artistic, but he believed that this was an artistic gift. He loved creative things, he loved inventing things, and oddly became the one thing that he was very good at. And it stayed with him for the rest of his life. He, as we'll see later throughout the series, he wasn't just able to master the handwriting. He was able to master the style, the tone, the rhythm. You know, he was able to look at a piece of paper and just go, yeah, okay, this is how that person writes. So, boat just rocked then. My neighbour's going past. The other day I was on the phone to my brother and I heard a boo, boo, boo. Horn was going really loud. I was like, what the hell is that? And I looked out, and one of the work boats that comes past, because the locks near me are being fixed, there's a work boat, and it's a big old boat, big old block of a boat, it's like a floating block of flats, and it probably weighs about 30 tons. They'd lost all propulsion, and the problem is your propulsion on your boat is not only pushes you forward, it's your brake as well, but also it's your steering, and they were going sideways, and were heading towards the boat in front. There's a big boat on the offside to me. Which is blocking my view, but it's fine because they protected me, my boat, from being hit by the big work boat. So they got smashed quite badly. I haven't seen the damage yet. Let's see. What else we got? As mentioned, he had no morbid thoughts. He wasn't interested in sex, do you know? So which really is very different from Reg Christie and Blackout Ripper, which is why I really wanted to focus on this story, because it's... the victims are very different, the method of murder is very different, and him as a person is very different as well. Do you know, there's no morbidity, there's no kind of really horrific violence. Well, I mean, there is, but it's kind of different in its own different way. What else we got? Yeah, no, he didn't really have... there was no major trauma in his early life. Do you know, no family relatives died. His parents stayed together throughout, always remained married. He had no real serious accidents as a child. Age 3, he fell, hit his head on the table, injured one of his ears. They said he was briefly unconscious. He wasn't seen by a doctor because it wasn't really a problem, and he had no long-term issues after that. Age 10, he fell down the stairs, injured his scalp. That was treated, he wasn't concussed. And in 1944, after he left prison, he was hit by a motor car, again injured his scalp, but wasn't unconscious. So, do you know, 3 injuries across the period of his whole life, And I think we've all probably had more than that in our lifetimes. And have we turned out badly? No. Good boy throughout his life. He always remembered his parents' birthdays and anniversaries. He'd always send them little gifts. Sometimes little ostentatious gifts, which is kind of weird given the fact that they're Plymouth Brethren. But I think that's it. Do we need to know any more? No. Mentioned about him being a boy. Obviously, he dressed his mum dressed him in smart suits with bow ties and shiny shoes. And although he was bullied, he stayed with him throughout his life. He loved the superiority of kind of, you know, feeling smart and going out and looking. Hence, he was always immaculate. You know, not an amazingly handsome man, a little kind of boyish little man with a lot of charm, but always immaculate. There was never really any kind of faults with how he was dressed, except as I've mentioned in the story. Or what I've tried to do with this story is you've probably gone, where's the big thing? Where's the big thing? And the big things aren't there. That's the whole point. You're probably going, where's the murder? Where's the references to this? Where's the weapons? Where's the... And everything you need to know is there. This is why this episode has taken so long to write. Because what I've tried to do is I've told you literally everything you need to know now. Everything you know is need to there. It's just I've wrapped it in a kind of a John George Hague shield. It's kind of this is I've tried to kind of told it as his story. So if you're wondering why I'm being sympathetic to him, I'm not being sympathetic to him at all. This is me telling his story. And obviously when I tell the victims, I'll tell their story. But this is his story. Therefore, it's his perspective. Do you know? So if things are glossed over, that's deliberately why I've done that. But yeah, no, everything you know need to know is there. Originally the ending was going to be slightly different. I was going to add in much more to an ending. But as I was writing it, I was like, it's not working right. So the ending that originally was going to end episode one is going to be the start of episode two. Because as I was sitting there, I was going, it just jars. It doesn't sit right. And then I realised that actually by telling you less, it was actually a better ending. So by just saying he was in prison, he would come out, he'd have to start at square one again. He'd learned a couple of things in prison, some useful skills, two things that were really important he learned in prison. And this is where his master plan began. This is where it began, but there was no murder to kick it off with. In fact, all that started it all was a dead mouse. And you go, right, how can you go from a serial killer who's killed six people and made sure that their bodies are never discovered, and you get to the end of the episode and basically he's done nothing. He's a polite boy, very sweet, very nice, tried really hard, failed quite a few times, kept trying, kept going back to square one. And by the end of it, all he's done is... I almost said it then. Even if you know the story, I mean, everyone knows this story probably. You can look at it online, that's fine, that's not a problem. But this is going to be a retelling. This would be, as you know, this would be my retelling, not the retelling. Not the same old retelling that everyone does, having looked on Wikipedia. This is my story, my spin on it. So... I found some really interesting ways of... It's taken me a while to work out this one, but I found some interesting ways of really telling this story in a different way. So this one, I told it in his way, but each victim as well. I like them because they're different victims in every way, but I found a kind of a correlation that no one's really picked up on before, and it's obvious. It's like... But you have to look into it deep to find it, and it's only by sitting here I've gone... Oh, that's why each victim is there. Because everyone just goes, well, they're all wealthy, that's why he's picked them. But it's not. There's a correlation between each victim and him. Each victim represents a period in his life. It represents something important in his life. And that's what I'm going to focus on, is that. To take you right from the start, right through every victim. And yeah, I'm looking forward to that. It's going to be really exciting. So much work to do, though. What else we got? Getting there. Didn't drink alcohol, didn't smoke. As you would have noticed, he was smoking. Did I put that in one of the episodes? I might have taken it out. I edit as I write, so I don't know. Didn't drink, didn't smoke. Although later in life, he wouldn't have a problem with people who did or drink or smoke. But later in life, as he got into his kind of 30s, if people offered him a sherry... Sherry? He wouldn't have a problem with that. He'd be like, yeah, of course, that's not a problem. He'd only have like half a sherry. He'd never drank, didn't do drugs. would smoke, but this doesn't seem to be something that he enjoyed. It seemed to be a social thing because it was quite popular at the time, and you know, he had cigarettes in like a gold cigarette box, so you know, it was a fashion thing. Didn't dance, didn't go out to nightclubs, didn't do those kind of things. So as a child, I think I might have not put this in, he was afraid of the dark, didn't like loud noises. As mentioned, he's quite fastidious. He always kept his hands clean. I'm going to try and put this into the later episodes, but he'd have a tendency to wear gloves all the time. Murder gloves. But not murder gloves. It was just, he wore gloves all the time because he was slightly obsessed with germs. But that's it. That really is him. And that's... So I hope you enjoyed that. I really wanted this to be a very different episode from all the others. I wanted you to kind of come to it thinking that you were going to get... like another Reg Christie or another Blackout Ripper, and like Ep 1 we'd hear, oh, this person got killed, and oh, it was horrific and all that. But that's deliberately what I didn't want in this episode. I wanted it to be kind of, oh, what's happened? Nothing's happened. Although everything's happened, everything is here, everything you need to know is there. It's just, I've deliberately held back a lot so we can just, because what I want is really, after you listen to episode 1 and you go, okay, that's episode 1, I understand who the character is. When we get into the episode 2, 3, 4, 5 and 6 and we meet all the other characters, by this point, you already know all about John George Hague. You know exactly what he's about. You know where he's coming from. You know what he's thinking when he's doing things. So when he meets someone, you know exactly what he wants to do with this, what he wants, what he sees them for, where they come from. Do you know, it's so we learn about their life. But at the same time, we also already know what he's going to think about them, what he sees from them. So, yeah, looking forward to this. Don't know how the rest of this is going to, how I'm going to write the rest of this, but I enjoyed that episode. It's difficult, but I enjoyed it. Right. Ooh, I burped then, sorry. I've waffled a lot. This is going to be a long episode. God, that was like 45 minutes of Extra Mile. You've missed Extra Mile for a while. Now you've just had a big old chunk. Right. I'm going to shut up because I'm going to go into town. I'm going to go into Costa because I don't have a generator. A new one hasn't turned out yet and the old one's buggered. I'm going to go into town, use their electricity, go to my post box and ask them why my stuff is missing. I ordered some more Murder Mile badges and fridge magnets and stuff like that for people who order mugs. And, if you're a Patreon subscriber, you get like a nice envelope. I'm just literally about to send one to Johnny Rex. Yes, so that is, I think I mentioned you in episode 2 next week, but because I'm ordering this now, I'm doing your envelope now today. That's going out. And Steph, I've just got your email. So Steph Thomas, so that's going to go out today. And I haven't even emailed you yet to tell you that I'm going to send you your envelope of goodies. But obviously, so I'm expecting more. Right, that was a lot of waffle. My tea's getting cold. Let's wrap this up. I don't remember how to end it, so let's just end it, okay? Thanks so much for listening, everyone. It's been very much appreciated. I hope you're enjoying the series. We've got 5 more episodes to go, then the obviously bits, and then I have a bit of a break. And then we come back for season 4, which is very exciting. So, and by then I'll be fat because I'll have eaten every cake that has ever existed. Oh, dear, it's going to happen, isn't it? I'm going to get fat again. Right, that's me done. Have yourselves a good week. Best wishes. Ta-ta. Bye!
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.